Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Have you ever had a nightmare neighbor? You know, a neighbor from hell? You know what I'm talking about. If so, we want to hear about it in our brand new podcast, Nightmare Neighbors. That's right. We got another one in the works. But we need your stories first. Go to NightmareNeighbors.com and send in your nightmare neighbor story. Or call in toll-free, 888-68-CRAZY, 888-68-CRAZY, and share your nightmare neighbor story with us. And we may talk about it and use it on a future episode of the Nightmare Neighbors podcast coming very soon. Maybe they're your current neighbors. Maybe they were a neighbor from years gone by. Now is the chance to tell your story anonymously. Go to NightmareNeighbors.com to share your nightmare neighbor story with us. Or call 888-68-CRAZY. And be part of the brand new Nightmare Neighbors podcast. What do you do when you're in the business of bringing smiles to children and families and you end up causing endless trauma and torment for your crew and the community you're visiting? Today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia, we visit the world of circus train disasters.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
The Hammond Circus train wreck occurred on June 22nd, 1918, during the last months of World War I. It was one of the worst train wrecks in U.S. history. 86 people were reported to have died, and another 127 were injured, when a locomotive engineer fell asleep and ran his train into the rear of another near Hammond, Indiana. The circus train held 400 performers from the Hangback Wallace Circus. The Hangback Wallace Circus used old wooden cars that were lit with oil lamps. The circus train had 2 train segments, and the segment that was loaded with animals had been dispatched earlier, leaving the train with all the performers and workers on the tracks. The cars were being moved to a spot near Gary, Indiana, so a mechanical problem could be addressed, and some of the cars had been left on the main line track. In the early morning hours of June 22, 1918, engineer Alonzo Sargent was at the throttle of a Michigan Central, then a subsidiary of the New York Central Railroad, troop train pulled by MCNYC Class K80R 462 Pacific Number 8485, with 20 empty Pullman cars. He was aware that his train was closely following a slower circus train. Sargent, an experienced man at the throttle, had slept little, if at all, in the preceding 24 hours. The effects of the lack of sleep, several heavy meals, some kidney pills, and the gentle rolling of his locomotive are thought to have caused him to fall asleep at the controls. At approximately 4 a.m., he missed at least 2 automatic signals and warnings posted by a brakeman of the 26-car circus train, which had made an emergency stop to check a hot box on one of the flat cars. The second train plowed into the caboose and 4 rear wooden sleeping cars of the circus train at a rail crossing known as Ivanhoe interlocking. Just a few miles east of Hammond, Indiana, at an estimated speed of 35 miles per hour. Upon impact, the circus train's lamps ignited the wooden cars, and the fire quickly spread. Two men were stationed at the Ivanhoe signal tower about 100 feet from the accident and phoned multiple people in an attempt to raise help for the victims. The first on the scene was the mayor of Gary, Indiana, who brought the fire chief and then phoned all the medical personnel he could. Triage for the victims was performed at the Michigan Central Railroad Station in Hammond, Indiana. Then they were sent to St. Margaret's Hospital. So oftentimes you think of, you know, circus trains, I guess what comes to most of our minds, because for most of us, circus trains weren't ever a thing. They were from a time gone by. So the closest that most of us got to circus trains were animal cracker boxes.
I actually saw a circus train.
A real train going down the tracks?
Yeah.
Really?
Ringling Brothers operated up until right before they stopped having a circus. They they still transported some animals on circus trains.
Okay.
So, yeah. But, I mean, they weren't wooden cars. They looked like converted passenger cars that, you know, almost like a cattle car kind of thing. But they still operated up into the 2000s.
That's interesting. I didn't know that they would actually go on train cars. I knew that they were operated, but I thought it all came on semis and stuff.
I think a lot of it did, but there were some towns where
the train still pulled up.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I have like pictures of me at like the Milwaukee Zoo in a train car, like behind, it was like a picture opportunity, but not like a legitimate, here's the real train car.
Sure.
But that would have been, you know, there was a time and place where that would have been a normal, there goes the train car with the circus train. It's just been interesting to see.
Yeah.
And to have that, that experience. Most of the 86 who were killed in the train wreck perished in the first 35 seconds after the collision. Then the wreckage caught on fire. The fire was so intense that many of the victims were believed to be some of the African-American porters on the train until further investigations revealed they had been severely burned. Among the dead were Arthur Dietrich and Max Nietzsche, the great Dietrich's brothers, the Strong Men Act, and Jenny Ward Todd of the Flying Wards. There were also 127 injuries. 5 days later, 53 of those killed were buried in Woodlawn Cemetery at the intersection of Sir Mark Road and De Plains Avenue in Forest Park, Illinois, in a section set aside as Showman's Rest, which had been purchased by the Showman's League of America only a few months earlier. This section is surrounded by statues of elephants in a symbolic mourning posture. Only 5 of those buried had been formally identified, so the graves of most of the casualties are marked unknown male or unknown female. One grave is marked Smiley, one Baldy, and another 4 Horse Driver. The more recent graves at the location belonged to people who traveled with the circus and wanted to be buried there after they died. The wreck is described in great detail in the report to the Joint Interstate Commerce Commission and Indiana Public Service Commission following an investigation. Sargent, who was under arrest, refused to testify at any of the hearings on advice of his counsel. In his report of the accident to the officials of the railroad company, he made the following statement. I was called shortly after 8 p.m. June 21st for Deadhead Equipment West. Engine 8485 for 10:15 p.m., and left Kalamazoo, Michigan at 10:35 p.m. He had been up since 5 a.m. June 21st, deadheading from my home in Jackson on trail number 41, and had little or no sleep during the day. Had a couple of heavy meals before going out, realizing that I would not get anything more to eat until sometime the next morning. Leaving Kalamazoo, followed freight train to Michigan City Yard and stopped at signal near Center Street. Got proceed signal from someone on ground, pulled up to Michigan City, stopped at Sandpipe and took water. While following this freight train, we stopped first between Dewaugut and Pokagon on account signal at danger. Stopped again. for some reason, for the train being ahead. Leaving Michigan City had clear track to East Gary, and there caught block of train ahead, reduced speed but did not have to stop as block cleared before it reached it. Reduced speed going through Gary to comply with rules, and saw no more signals or caution to danger until approaching curve east of Ivanhoe, where I found second signal east of wreck at caution. Was going about 25 miles per hour at this point, but did not reduce speed as I expected that the next signal would probably clear before I got to it, or that I would see it, if at danger, in time to stop. The wind was blowing very hard into cab on my side, and I closed the window, which made the inside of the cab more comfortable. Before reaching the next signal, I dozed on account of heat in cab and missed it, not realizing what had happened to me until I was in 75 to 90 feet. I awoke suddenly and saw the trail or marker lights showing red on the train directly ahead of me, not realizing that the rear end of this train was so close. I started to make a service application, but before completing it, placed brake valve handle into emergency position. We struck almost instantly after making the brake application. Don't know whether I closed the throttle or not, but I think I did. Looked to see where the fireman was, and saw that he was running towards the gangway. Did not see a fuse, hear a torpedo, or see any other warning signal up to time. I saw the red taillights. Wreck happened about 4:05 a.m. June 22nd, and I stayed there for an hour or more assisting in getting people out of the wreckage. I've been in the service for the Michigan Central Railroad Company for approximately 28 or 29 years, the last 16 of which I have been continuously employed as an engineer. I'm in perfect physical condition as well as mental condition, and I've had no illnesses within 25 or 30 years requiring the service of a doctor. There was nothing defective about the air brakes or other mechanism of the engine or train that I was operating, nor was there any defective condition of any of the signals or track upon which I was operating, to the best of my knowledge. The accident was due solely to the fact that I accidentally fell asleep and had no intent to injure any person, nor was same done with malice, but solely through an accident, as foresaid. The ICC report concluded this accident was caused by engine man sergeant being asleep, and from this cause failing to observe the stop indication of automatic signal 2581 and the warnings of the flagman of the circus train, and to be governed by them. The report was also critical of the older wooden cars whose oil lamps may have ignited the fire immediately after collision. Although Sergeant and his fireman, Gustav Klaus, were criminally charged in Lake County, Indiana following a trial, the jury found itself deadlocked and a mistrial was declared. Prosecutors declined to retry the case and charges were dismissed June 9th, 1920. So how do you feel about that? How do you feel about him coming up and saying, look, there's nothing wrong with the train. There's nothing wrong with anything other than me. I fell asleep. He was accountable for it.
Yeah.
He said, look, I screwed up and this was my fault. Do you feel like their justice was served? It was a mistrial, or do you think it was, no, he ended up living with that guilt for the rest of his life?
I feel like with the way that he did come out and he didn't try and blame it on anything else, and he was very forthcoming with what exactly happened. He's going to live with those 86 deaths the rest of his life.
Or did.
Yeah. I mean, he's obviously gone now. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he survived the wreck itself is still amazing to me. Because I'm sure that at that point, he's probably wishing he hadn't survived himself.
Well, I'm wondering, because I was wondering if he was going to touch on that. Like, did he jump off the engine as it got close, or was he still in there and he just happened to survive the collision? Or, you know, it makes me wonder.
That I don't know. I don't.
Because I could see, like, if you're getting really close and you're about to collide, you just go out the door and jump and hope for the best.
But we're talking, you know, a steam engine versus wooden cars, too.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, I think it's terrible what happened. I do think he did the right thing by saying, you know, here's exactly what happened. I am at fault.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know, I don't know that he should have been put in jail for an accident. Because it wasn't, it was a true accident. It wasn't negligence. It wasn't anything malicious. It was just
human error.
Human error. Yeah. And you know, we still see things like that happen too, where, you know, it's not so much trains, but airline pilots, you know, that work shifts that are just insane, you know, and they end up, you know, occasionally there was one in New York not that long ago where it was just a matter of they had been on duty for over 24 hours.
Well, it's crazy some of the hours that they, I mean, this is pre-pandemic when people were flying.
Yeah.
Some of the crazy shifts and hours that they had people working. I saw something about it. I don't know what it was on. It was in one of the news magazine shows, probably Dateline or something. But it was amazing. And it really made you uncomfortable flying because it's just like, oh my God, the hours that these folks work and the odd hours and they get up, get on the plane, get up at this time, get up at that time. And I know that it's regulated to a certain extent, but at the same point, you know, the flying conditions or the places that they have for some of the folks, the pilots and crew to like rest, they're not necessarily going to the Best Western down the road.
No.
Sometimes the airlines themselves have like cots in their areas of the airports that are private, but it's just like, oh my gosh, you're doing this for like a week. And then you're, you know, I'm just trying to think, you know, on a daily basis, me being sharp here in my office and my bedroom is over there.
Yeah.
Trying to be sharp flying an aircraft and you're just jerked around left and right to all these unfamiliar spaces that are not yours and uncomfortable. And then trying to be sharp enough to be doing that job would be, I think, a challenge. I suppose you get, you know, somewhat used to it over time, but it's not what I think a lot of us think of when it comes to airline pilots, where there's a lot of illusion there of, oh, you know, it's the pilot. They must be, you know, they're staying at the really nice hotel over there and this or the, no, it's not how it works.
Well, not, I mean, once they get to a certain point, maybe, you know, but it's very much when you start out,
It's crazy.
Yeah.
You know? It's one of those careers where if you love it, you love it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, and that's how a lot of the airlines can get away with paying them so little at first. It's amazing how little starting out airline pilots work get paid for some of the smaller aircraft. But it's one of those things where if you love it, it's just there's nothing else. It's like, you know, with radio back in the day where it's like, if you love it, you know, it doesn't matter what you're making because you're doing what you love.
Yeah.
And it's one of those type of careers, you know, when you try and work your way up. An interesting point about this one was how quickly they got back back on the train, if you will.
The show must go on.
Yeah, the show must go on. They canceled two shows, one on the 23rd and 24th, but then by the 25th, they were back in Beloit, Wisconsin, with some other circuses in the area providing extra shows, extra help. But they were back out there doing their show. That would have to be just crazily difficult.
Yeah.
You know,
could you imagine you've lost, you know, 86 out of however many of your show and to be expected to perform less than a week later?
And bring joy to people?
Yeah.
And it's not like, here's the tribute show and we're all just depressed. But you're like, people are there. They're lined up. They're, you know, bring us joy. And like half your family's dead. Because a lot of the circus folks, this is their family pretty much.
Yeah.
It's not just like a coworker you see, you go to work and it's just your family. And half of them just died in this horrible wreck. And then you're trying to get your show together. My God, I don't know how. But yeah, I guess, you know, when they say the show must go on, I think it harkens back to some of these horrific days.
And then to continue to move on to the next town by train and never knowing if that's going to happen again.
Yeah, I don't think that would.
I don't think I could do it. I think I would be too afraid that same thing would happen again.
Well, good news. If you haven't had enough circus disaster magic for one episode, we have more circus disasters to talk about.
This one's different, though. This one's not a train wreck.
In this episode of the program. So, continuing on, the Hartford Circus Fire. The Hartford Circus Fire, which occurred on July 6, 1944 in Hartford, Connecticut, was one of the worst fire disasters in United States history. The fire occurred during an afternoon performance of the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus that was attended by 6,000 to 8,000 people. The fire killed 162 people and more than 700 were injured. In the mid-20th century America, a typical circus traveled from town to town by train, performing under a huge canvas tent, commonly known as a big top. The Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus was no exception. Which made it stand out was that it was the largest circus in the country. Its big top could seat 9,000 spectators around its three rings. The tent's canvas had been coated with 1,800 pounds of paraffin wax dissolved in 6,000 U.S. gallons of gasoline, a common waterproofing method of the time. The circus had been experiencing shortages of personnel and equipment as a result of the United States' involvement in World War II. Delays and malfunctions in the ordinary smooth order of the circus had become commonplace. On August 4, 1942, a fire had broken out in the menagerie, killing a number of animals. When the circus arrived in Hartford, Connecticut on July 5, 1944, the trains were so late that one of the two shows scheduled for that day had been canceled. In circus superstition, missing a show is considered extremely bad luck. And although the July 5, 1944 evening show ran as planned, many circus employees had been on their guard, half expecting an emergency or catastrophe. The next day was a Thursday. The crowd at the afternoon performance was dominated by women and children. The size of the audience that day had never been established with certainty, but at best estimate, about 7,000. The fire began as a small flame after the lions performed on the southwest side wall of the tent, while the great Wallidus were performing. Circus band leader Merle Evans was said to have been the first to spot the flames and immediately directed the band to play The Stars and Stripes Forever, the tune that traditionally signaled distress to all circus personnel. Ringmaster Fred Brenda urged the audience not to panic and to leave in an orderly fashion, but the power failed and he could not be heard. Brandna and the ushers unsuccessfully tried to maintain some order as the panicked crowd tried to flee the big top. The only animals in the big top at the time were the big cats, trained by May Kovar and Joseph Walsh, that had just finished performing when the fire started. The big cats were herded through the chutes leading from the performing cages to several cage wagons and were unharmed except for a few minor burns. Though most spectators were able to escape the fire, many people were caught up in the hysteria. Witnesses, some simply ran around in circles trying to find their loved ones rather than trying to escape from the burning tent. Some escaped but ran back inside to look for family members. Others stayed in their seats until it was too late, assuming that the fire would be put out promptly. Because at least two of the exits were blocked by the circus chutes used to bring the show's big cats in and out of the tent, people trying to escape could not bypass them. The cause of the fire remains unsolved. Investigators at the time believed it was caused by a carelessly flicked cigarette, however others suspected an arsonist. Several years later, while being investigated on other arson charges, Robert Dale Seege, who was an adolescent at the time, confessed to starting the blaze. He was never tried for the crime and later recanted his confession. Because of the paraffin wax waterproofing of the tent, the flames spread rapidly. Many people were badly burned by the melting paraffin, which rained down from the roof. The fiery tent collapsed in about 8 minutes, according to eyewitness survivors, trapping hundreds of spectators beneath it. Because of a picture that appeared in several newspapers of sad tramp clown Emmett Kelly holding a water bucket, the event became known as the Day the Clowns Cried. While many people burned to death, many others died as a result of the ensuing chaos. Sources and investigators differ on how many people were killed and injured, and various people and organizations say it was 167, 168, or 169. The 168 figure is usually based on official tallies that included a collection of body parts that were listed as victim, with officials treated injuries estimated over 700 people. The number of actual injuries is believed to be higher than those figures, since many people were seen that day, heading home in shock without seeking treatment in the city. It's commonly believed that the number of fatalities is higher than the estimates given due to poorly kept residency records in rural towns and the fact that some smaller remains were never identified or claimed. Additionally, free tickets had been handed out that day to many people in and around the city, some of whom appeared to be eyewitnesses and circus employees to be drifters who would never have been reported missing. Some died from injuries sustained after leaping from the tops of the bleachers in hopes they could escape under the sides of the tent. That method of escape ended up killing more than it saved. Others died after being trampled by other spectators, with some asphyxiated underneath the piles of people who fell over each other. Most of the dead were found in piles, some three bodies deep, at the most congested exits. A small number of people were found alive at the bottoms of these piles, protected by the bodies on top of them when the burning big top ultimately fell down. It sounds like a lovely day at the circus, doesn't it?
I've never been to a tent circus.
I don't know that they do tent circuses anymore.
No, they don't do any circuses anymore, but they did do tent circuses, you know, during our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, traveling ones. I remember when I worked for the Chamber of Commerce in the town where I grew up, we had a traveling circus that came to town and set up in the park. And it was like you saw in Dumbo, where the elephants were used to help raise the tent.
Yeah.
And I was not able to take part and watch that. I would have loved to have seen that, just as, especially it doesn't happen anymore. But I never went to a circus in a tent. I've been to circuses, but they were like in arenas, you know. But gosh, could you imagine the raining down of the hot wax trying to get out during all that?
I just would like to picture that happening during a Circus of the Stars, which was a great 1980s television show. Did you ever watch Circus of the Stars?
Of course, everybody watched Circus of the Stars. Who didn't watch that?
Was it brought back like in the early 2000s or something?
I don't know, but that's one of those things. It's like a train wreck. No pun intended. You can't look away.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to say it came back like shortly after 9/11. I could be completely wrong on that.
To bring joy to America?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you know, that worked.
Well, we had so many shows that started popping up like right after that were so kitsch, like Dancing with the Stars and things like that. I want to say that Circus of the Stars tried to make I could be wrong. I should Wikipedia that, but
they should bring that back. I'd watch that shit show.
It'd be great.
I would totally watch that. I could care less about Dancing with the Stars because they just, most of them look stupid, but I think, you know, watching somebody potentially fall from a trapeze that's famous.
And the threat, they should do it in the tent. They should line the tent with gasoline and wax, just like this. And then there's always a possibility, one on a very special Circus of the Stars.
On a very special Circus of the Stars.
Yeah. They make it like Backdraft 2.
Oh, God.
On a very special Circus of the Stars. And then William Shatner comes out too, and it's like a combination of Backdraft, Rescue 911, and Circus of the Stars all together.
Okay.
It would be great. That would be television gold. Let's continue on with this story as they dive into the investigation. On July 7th, 1944, charges of involuntary manslaughter were filed against five officials and employees of Ringling Brothers. Within days of these charges being filed, the circus reached an agreement with Hartford officials to accept full financial responsibility and pay whatever amount the city requested in damages. This resulted in the circus paying almost $5 million to the 600 victims and families who had filed claims against them by 1954. All circus profits from the time of the fire until then had been set aside to pay off these claims. Although the circus accepted full responsibility for the financial damages, they did not accept responsibility for the disaster itself. Five men were charged, were brought to trial in late 1944. Four were convicted. Although they were given prison terms, the four men found guilty were allowed to continue with the circus to their next stop in Sarasota, Florida, to help the company set itself up again after the disaster. Shortly after their convictions, they were pardoned entirely. One of the men, James A. Haley, went on to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives for 24 years. Seege's confession in 1950, Robert Dale Seege of Circleville, Ohio, claimed during a police interview that he was responsible for setting the circus fire. Following the Ohio police interview, Seege signed a statement admitting to setting the circus fire and a series of other fires and several murders since his youth. Seege, a 16-year-old roustabout for the show from June 30th to July 14th, 1944, claimed that he had a nightmare in which an American Indian riding on a flaming horse told him to set fires. According to police authorities, Seege further stated that after this nightmare, his mind went blank, and by the time it cleared, the circus fire had been set. Some of Seege's hand-drawn images of his bizarre dreams and images depicting his claimed murders appeared in Life magazine on July 17, 1950. In November of 1950, Seege was convicted in Ohio of unrelated arson charges and sentenced to 44 years prison time. However, Hartford investigators raised doubts over his confession, and he had a history of mental illness, and it could not be proven he was anywhere within the state of Connecticut when the fire occurred. Connecticut officials were also not allowed to question Seege, even though his alleged crime had occurred in their state. Additionally, Seege, who died in 1997, denied setting the fire as late as 1994 during an interview. Because of this, many investigators, historians, and victims believe the true arsonist, if it had indeed been arson, was never found. The best-known victim of the circus fire was a young blonde girl wearing a white dress. She's known only as Little Miss 1565, named after the number assigned to her body at the city's makeshift morgue. Oddly well preserved even after her death, her face has become arguably the most familiar image of the fire. Her true identity has been a topic of debate and frustration in the Hartford area since the fire occurred. She was buried without a name in Hartford's Northwood Cemetery, where a victim's memorial also stands. Two police investigators, Sergeants Thomas Barber and Edward Lowe, photographed her and took fingerprints, footprints, and dental charts. Despite massive publicity and repeated displays of the famous photograph in nationwide magazines, she was never claimed. Barber and Lowe spent the rest of their lives trying to identify her. They decorated her grave with flowers each Christmas, Memorial Day, and July 4th. After their deaths, a local flower company continued to decorate the grave. In 1991, the body was declared to be that of Eleanor Emily Cook, despite the fact that her aunt and uncle had examined the body and it did not fit the description they provided. The Connecticut State Police Forensic Unit compared her hair samples and determined they were probably from the same person. The body was exhumed in 1991 and buried next to her brother Edward, who had also died in the fire. In 1981, Lowe's widow announced that Lowe had identified the child and contacted her family, but they had requested no publicity. In 1987, someone left a note on the 1565 gravestone reading, "Sarah Graham is her name, 7638 DOB, 6 years twin." Notes on nearby gravestones indicated that her twin brother and other relatives were buried close by. In 1991, arson investigator Rick Davey, along with co-writer Don Macy, published A Matter of Degree, The Hartford Circus Fire, and Mystery of Little Miss 1565, in which he claims the girl was Eleanor Emily Cook and from Massachusetts. Davey also contends that there was a conspiracy within the judicial system to convict the ringling defendants and that Seege was the arsonist. Before writing the book, Davey spent 6 years researching the case and conducting his own experiments as to how the fire really may have started. He described the original investigation as both flawed and primitive. Though he did not work on the original case, Eleanor's brother, Donald Cook, had contacted authorities in 1955 insisting that the girl was his sister, but nothing came of it, and Donald later worked with Davey to establish her identity. Donald believes that family members were shown the wrong body in the confusion at the morgue. Various assertions put forth in A Matter of Degree have been fiercely disputed by investigators who worked on the case, as well as by other writers, most notably Stuart Onan, who published The Circus Fire, A True Story of an American Tragedy, in 2001. Onan points to the fact that Little Miss 1565 had blonde hair, while Eleanor Cook was a brunette. The shape of Little Miss 1565's face and that of Eleanor Cook are dissimilar, and the heights and ages of the two girls do not match up. Perhaps most significantly, when shown a photograph of Little Miss 1565, Eleanor's mother, Mildred Parsons, Cook immediately stated that this was not her daughter. She firmly maintained that stance until her death in 1997 at age 91. Badly injured in the fire, Miss Cook had been unable to claim her two dead children and was too emotionally traumatized to pursue it later. She had been told that Eleanor was not in any of the locations where bodies were kept for identification. She believed that Eleanor was one of the two children who had been burnt beyond recognition and remained unidentified. Onan thinks she may be body number 1503. He further points to the differences in the dental records of Eleanor Cook and the records made of Little Miss 1565 after her death. As Onan and others have pointed out, the most likely scenario is that a family claiming a body earlier mistakenly identified Eleanor Cook as their own child, and she is buried under that child's name. Even when Little Miss 1565's picture ran in the papers, they failed to recognize her as their own due to their desire to put the traumatic event behind them. While DNA analysis could end this debate definitively, the logistics of exhuming all the likely candidates for this mix-up make this unlikely. With the questions over whether Eleanor Cook is the true identity of Little Miss 1565 still unanswered in the eyes of many, the body was exhumed after the release of a matter of degree and buried in Southampton, Massachusetts, next to the body of Edward Cook, the brother of Eleanor Cook, and a victim of the circus fire himself. In 1992, her death certificate was officially changed from the previous identification of 1565. Since then, the Cook family has raised questions about whether the body is indeed that of Eleanor Cook, and some investigators have come to believe Eleanor's body may have been another of the unclaimed bodies from the fire, and not Little Miss 1565.
I can understand not being able to claim a body that's been burned so beyond recognition to where, you know, they didn't have the technology at the time to identify it.
Sure.
But this, have you ever seen the picture? It just looks like a little girl asleep. You can completely tell everything about this little girl.
I have not.
And it's like, how can somebody not know who this child is? You know, it's not like it's a gruesome photo. It just looks like a death photo. I mean, she's just, that one I don't get. Somebody has to know her.
Yeah, it looks very identifiable.
Yeah.
And how you would not, I mean, unless the parents had died as well, and that was the only family that was left.
Right.
And then just no one was able to identify. I mean, that's the only thing that would seem to make sense.
Right.
But no. I've seen this circus fire picture before. It's like one of those that you see is like of horrible disasters and stuff.
Yeah.
And that does look, that looks pretty horrific.
Yeah, I think that qualifies as horrific, Tony.
Yeah, I think that gets the horrific award of the day. That's probably wouldn't make a good Circus of the Stars. That would not be something that wouldn't work on network.
No. You know,
that just wouldn't fly. It's interesting. Here's one more chapter of this, of some personal accounts of people who went through it. I'm interested to hear some of that or to read some of that. Let's dive into that portion of the story. One of the survivors of the fire, Maureen Creakin, discussed her ordeal in 2007. She was 11 at the time of the fire and lived on the same road where the circus was held. On the day of the event, she was supposed to go to the circus with a woman next door and her daughter. When she went to their house, she found that they had already left without her. She decided to go to the circus on her own, where she seated herself in the bleachers. I remember somebody yelling and seeing a big ball on fire near the top of the tent, and this ball of fire just got bigger and bigger and bigger. By that time, everybody was panicking. The exit was blocked with cages that the animals were brought in and out with, and there was a man taking kids and flinging them up and over that cage to get them out. I was sitting up in the bleachers and jumped down. I was three quarters of the way up. You jumped down and it was all straw underneath. There was a young man, a kid, and he had a pocket knife. And he slit the tent, took my arm, and pulled me out. As she was being pulled out, Kirkin grabbed another little girl's arm and pulled her out as well. Actor and theater director Charles Nelson Riley, who was 13 years old at the time, survived the fire and dramatized it in the film of his stage show, The Life of Riley. In a 1997 interview, Riley said that he rarely attended the theater, despite being a director, since the sound of a large audience in a theater reminded him of the large crowd at the circus before the disaster. He also said during his later show that his mother, whom he had disobeyed after she told him not to go to the circus on the day with his friend, caught them sneaking out of her sight and scolded them, saying, "I hope it burns to the ground." Frida Pushnik, who performed with the circus as the armless and legless wonder, was rescued by a minstrel show performer. She could not have gotten away on her own, but the minstrel performer rushed on stage, picked up her chair, and carried her to safety. Pushnik continued to perform with the circus until 1955. Those who survived carried the trauma for decades. 70 years after the fire, Carol Tillman Parrish, who was 6 at the time, said that, "Until this day, I can smell the stench of human flesh as the blaze consumed its victims." Judith Shapiro Cohen survived the fire. She was about 7 years old, attending with her neighbors. They exited up higher into the stands and survived by jumping off. Judith refused to jump and was pushed. While many of those present at the fire have avoided circuses ever since, others have returned. In May of 2004, Dorothy Carvey and her son Teague were given free passes for their family by Ringling Brothers to attend a show at the XL Center. For Dorothy Carvey, this was her first time attending a circus since the fire occurred. The Hartford Courant published the story of her visit as well as what happened to them in 1944. In 2002, the Hartford Circus Fire Memorial Foundation was established to erect a permanent memorial to the people killed at the fire. Ground was broken for the monument on July 6, 2004, at the site where the fire occurred. Ringling Brothers and Vitamin Bailey visited Hartford during its final tour, putting on its final performance there on April 30th, 2017. Be an odd phone call. "Hey, I know you were at that fire as a child. How would you like some free tickets this weekend? And free hot dog vouchers." I think the hot dog vouchers would put me over the edge. Even if I was like, that was really traumatic, I still cry myself to sleep about it every day. Hot dog vouchers, fuck yeah, I'm in.
I want to know how many times Ringling went back to Hartford in between the fire and the last show they ever did. Did they ever make that a routine stop, or was that too traumatic for the community to the point where they thought, maybe we should just go the next town over and just leave these poor people alone?
I don't know. It's interesting putting on its final performance there April 30th of 2017. Now, is that their final performance overall?
That was it.
That was like their final stop. It was the end of the tour date. And They picked that location. That's a weird one to pick.
That's what I was thinking.
You know, it's one thing where you do, I don't know. I mean, it just seems like an odd one to pick to do your final show at. I would think you'd like pick like where you started or where was your first.
Yeah.
Which would have been like Baraboo, Wisconsin or something like that. It seems odd that you go to the site of the tragedy to reenact. I mean, you're not reenacting the tragedy, but you're doing the show there. I mean, although most people for the most part are dead who would have been there in 2017. Is it just so, removed from consciousness?
No, there's got to be a reason they chose it, because of all the places to choose that one. And there's nobody in that company that doesn't know about Hartford.
Sure, they know about it, but it wouldn't be like an immediate traumatic event anymore because you wouldn't have lived through it. That's what I mean. It's like one of those things where, well, we heard about it. We know about it in history books. We understand it was horrible and tragic, but there's that disconnect.
I just think it's weird that they chose basically the place where their circus is going to die. The last show.
Yeah.
To go back there.
The place where a lot of people did die watching their show. It is weird. It strikes me as an odd, I don't know if it was viewed as like, well, this would be a great tribute. Was that what the mindset was? I just don't get it. I don't feel tribute in that sort of a, you know, I don't view it as like a mocking of the dead or anything, but it just feels like a weird thing.
It feels like a suicide at the place where you lost a bunch of family.
Okay, that's a good analogy.
That's what it feels like. And I don't know that was the intent of it or the intent, but that's how it came across to me. It's like, let's just go have our final show at this tragic spot. Okay.
Yeah.
A little sick.
Just seems a little bizarre.
It's done.
There you go. Circus disasters today. Thank you for putting that one together.
Sure.
Were circus disasters always something that you were fascinated by as a little girl?
Circuses are always creepy. Yeah. So I've been to them, but I still don't enjoy them.
Yeah. There you go. That wraps up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Until next time, for Jenny, I'm Tony. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're listening. Don't miss any episodes of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Hope everybody is doing their best right now as we're going through this crazy time in our world. I'm Tony Bruschi, host of Real Ghost Stories Online. Wanted to invite you and let you know about our other brand new podcast that we just launched, Help Kill the Time for You. It's called The Dark Side of Wikipedia. It's about true crime and dark history. We dive into some of the strangest, most disturbed minds and experiences from our history and examine their story, their Wikipedia entry, and then discuss the cases, the individuals, and the psychology of the events as we go through each and every story. Some of our first episodes include Ed Gein, the BTK Killer, the New London School Explosion, Amityville Murders, Richard Speck, Amelia Dyer, the General Slocum Disaster, Jeffrey Dahmer, and more. New episodes every single week. Check out Dark Side of Wikipedia. Search it. Subscribe wherever you download podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and more. It's available now with new episodes every single week. Dark Side of Wikipedia. Search and subscribe today and stay safe out there.